Wolf, get away from those sheep.
Bollocks.
You're listening to the Wolf and the Shepherd podcast, broadcasting from Fort Worth in the great state of Texas. Now, get ready for this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd.
Welcome to this episode of the Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we have with us Joe DePinto. Joe, glad you could join us today.
Really happy to be here, Max, Tristan. Thanks for having me, guys.
So, Joe, we're in the middle, roughly, of this great resignation that's been going on for about 9 months to a year. And somehow you found yourself with two jobs, Bar Pay and Haste Arcade. Could you just briefly kind of give the background to both of those companies and how you're the kind of glue that joins those two together?
Man, yeah, the great resignation. That's a good term. I actually haven't heard that one before, but it makes sense. And we've seen a lot of that in the first one, Bar Pay, the company you mentioned. But yeah, a little bit of background on how I've kind of gotten here and the journey that it's taken. My story is tied together with my co-founder, Dan Wagner, who we met playing professional baseball, of all things, after college. We were in the Chicago White Sox minor league system. And we both, you know, had the same idea of life after baseball. We didn't want to be, you know, slaves to the game is what we kind of called it. We would see a lot of our friends or, you know, other coaches along the way that we had met who they played. They got to a pretty high level, never really made it to the major leagues, or even if they did and had like a short career after that, it's like, you know, they're a scout or they're a minor league manager and they're living, you know, in small college towns, traveling on a bus 6 months out of the year. Which nothing wrong with that, but we just kind of figured like that wasn't really what we wanted out of life. We didn't want to let baseball, you know, be the end all be all for our stories. And Dan, super creative guy, studied music production at Belmont in Nashville. I went to USC and was more of a business and communications major myself. So we had a pretty good like meshing of different talents. But basically our careers both ended the same year, 2014. He was living, he's from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm from Los Angeles, where I still live, and Dan's actually moved out here at this point. But basically, we kept in touch. We had this concept called Bar Pay from our experiences playing minor league baseball. And just to give you guys a little insight on that, it's like, you know, you play your games from 7 to 10 at night. After that, you have, you know, an hour or so before curfew where you have to get back to the hotel. And really the only things that are open to get, you know, dinner at are your local bars, pubs, whatnot. So we were constantly finding ourselves in this environment of, okay, we got to hurry and get to the bar and then hurry and get home. And it's like, how many credit cards do we lose on the road? How many times do we have to wait 10 minutes for a bartender to close out our tab? Frustrations that a lot of people have had, you know, but you think about it, it's like, how come no one's really addressed this problem? How come no one's fixed this? And you think about the bar industry in general, they've been doing the same thing for thousands of years. You walk up, you tell some guy what you want, he brings it to you and he tells you to pay him. It's like no one's really messed with that process for a long time. And so we were young and crazy enough and enjoyed going to bars enough when we were 24, 25 that we were like, oh, we can, you know, build an app and solve this or whatever. Obviously, neither of us having any programming experience whatsoever, building an app was not something that we could do. So we had to contract all that. But anyways, we ended up getting BarPay built. We launched it in 2016 out here in Los Angeles. I went to USC and there's really only one bar at USC, which is called the 901 Bar and Grill. It's been around for like 50 or 60 years. One of those legendary, you know, college dive bars where you have great stories that you don't really remember, but they're great stories anyways. And in essence, we kicked it off there. It went really well. We did the same thing. That same ownership group ended up opening the equivalent bar across town at UCLA. Same results. Kids really liked it. It did make the whole process of ordering and paying, you know, for your drinks and your food, especially in the late night crowd, a lot easier. Didn't lose any credit cards and the students seemed to like it. So we felt like we were definitely onto something. But it was through those experiences with Bar Pay and working with these different bar owners, learning about, you know, their frustrations, because we had only thought about it as customers up to that point where, you know, what can make my life more convenient when I'm in a busy crowded bar. The owners that we're talking to are like, you know, my bar is already full. This sounds like a cool thing for my customers, but what can you actually do? What benefits can you give me? And one of the things that kept coming up was credit card processing rates. So just a real quick spiel on credit card processing rates. you swipe a Visa card right now, basically at any store, it's going to take 24 to 48 hours for that money to actually hit that merchant's bank account. And they're going to lose anywhere from 2 to 4% just to the credit card processing fees. So as you know, 24, 25 year olds, we're looking into this, and somehow we stumble upon this thing called Bitcoin. And Bitcoin's promise was the transactions are basically instant. So you don't have to wait the 24 to 48 hours to get the payments. You receive them instantly. And the cost to actually send that money is like fractions of a penny instead of 2 to 4%. So we saw this and we're like, holy smokes, like there's something, you know, really cool about this. We can't really do anything with it right now, but it piqued our interest and it got us paying attention to what Bitcoin was. And obviously that was back in 2014, 2015, when we first started researching it, up to about 2017, when you had a whole bunch of the ICOs, you had like Ethereum launched, you had all these new tokens and coins coming out. And that's where myself and Dan started to see the narrative of this Bitcoin thing change. And what I mean by that is we were attracted to it originally, not because the price was going up, but because you could actually use this to solve like a pretty cool business problem, which was the credit card processing rates and the speed of transactions. And so tying this all together, you know, we started getting frustrated seeing this thing that we had been, you know, really excited about get further and further away from being that, you know, what the title of the Bitcoin white paper is peer-to-peer cash. And all of a sudden it's being called like digital gold. And all of a sudden it's taking a day for a transaction to process and it's costing $10, $20, $50 when it really got a lot of action in 2017. And we're just like, what the heck happened? Like, this is not what this was supposed to be, yet the value of this thing keeps going up tremendously. And so we're kind of like sitting there scratching our heads, not really sure what to make of any of it. And this just continued up until like last year, even where we're still just sitting there. And I mean, we had Bitcoin at a pretty early state compared to most people, but we exchanged most of our actual Bitcoin and Ethereum out of Bitcoin into, I don't know if you guys are familiar with like the forks, but you have Bitcoin, you have Bitcoin Cash. So when we saw that fork, it was like, well, Bitcoin Cash is the one that you can actually use for peer-to-peer transactions. It's the one that has utility. Clearly, that should be the one that people, you know, want to purchase. So we sold all of our BTC into Bitcoin Cash. And we might have made a mistake on that in terms of the value of both nowadays. But we were just looking at it from like a utility perspective. It's like, well, you know, people are obviously going to see that this one is the one that makes sense to own, but you can't do anything with the other one. And same thing then happened in 2018. You had Bitcoin Cash fork into Bitcoin SV. And the main difference between those two, we felt, was that the Bitcoin Cash community was really about this idea of like no government, no regulations, kind of like anything goes, which is fine. But we always thought that for one of these blockchains to actually get like mainstream and global adoption, you're going to have to play nicely with governments and with regulators. Like they're not going anywhere in the near term. Like if you're not actually working with them to get your currency or your blockchain in regulatory compliance, there's going to come a day when the government's just like, all right, you're done. Shink. Like that's it. So the Bitcoin SV camp was still preaching the same things that originally, you know, attracted us to Bitcoin: super low transaction fees, super fast transaction speeds. But they were also saying, we want this for global, like enterprise adoption. We want this to scale. We want to work with governments and regulators and make this a blockchain that, you know, checks all the boxes. So from our perspective, it's like, okay, this is what we were originally attracted to in the current form. What can we now do to show people in the real world, hey, Bitcoin isn't this digital gold thing? Like, I don't know what the heck that narrative is. There's some conspiracies and rabbit holes I could go down that kind of get to that point. But at simplest value, what we wanted to do was just show someone, show our friends even, hey, there's this thing called Bitcoin, and you can do it to do these things called microtransactions, which to me is really cool. What a microtransaction would be, you know, sending something less than a dollar, sending a dime or a nickel or a penny or even fractions of a penny digitally, which right now you can't do that with a traditional credit card for processing rates called interchange fees. They have like a constant fixed cost. Like the lowest you're ever going to be able to go would really be about a dollar if you're trying to send that digitally. And that's why you see like at gas stations, the example I always use, if you spend $5 or less, they tack on like a 50-cent, you know, service fee. That's because they're having to fight that processing charge that they're incurring as the merchant. Well, our concept was, we know that you can do this thing called microtransactions. We think this is somewhat of the initial goal and vision of Bitcoin. How do we break up a quarter into 100 different, you know, fractions of a cent and send it to 100 of our friends at the same time? It's like, that's a pretty simple idea. Like, what's the trigger going to be? Like, let's just create a simple game where basically however you do in this game, you earn spot 1 through 100 on the leaderboard, and then you get a certain percentage of every subsequent quarter that's spent playing that game based on where you are on the leaderboard. So the simple example is you go to an arcade, you put a quarter in the Pac-Man machine, you get on the leaderboard. Well, in the old school, like, it's like, okay, cool, I'm on the leaderboard. I get to put my initials, ASS, SEX, whatever, you know, the kids are doing these days. And that was it. You come back a month later and like, maybe your initials are still up there, maybe not. But with us, if you make that leaderboard, now every time someone plays on that machine after you, you're going to get a certain percentage of their quarter. So we call that instant leaderboard payouts. And that's something that is only possible with blockchain, and specifically with the BSV blockchain, Bitcoin SV. So I guess to kind of tie those two concepts together, BarPay and what Haste has turned into, is BarPay, you know, still a company, exists today. We've got about 15,000 accounts in the bar and restaurant industry, does QR code digital menus. We were one of the very first to put those out at the beginning of the pandemic. But because what we learned through BarPay about credit card processing rates, we were able to then, you know, build this Haste game, the very first simple game I was talking about, where basically what the game ended up being was, if you looked at your phone screen, you hit play game, the screen goes blank. Sometime within the next 2 seconds, a little dot's going to pop up somewhere on your screen. And the only purpose of the game is to just tap the dot as fast as you can. So if Max taps it at 397 milliseconds and I tap it at 280 milliseconds and Tristan taps it at 476 milliseconds, right, we're each going to have different spots on that leaderboard. But that's the whole purpose of the game. So we built that game. It had a huge reception within the Bitcoin SV community because it was like, boom, like here's a super simple example of microtransactions in the real world. Someone actually using blockchain technology for something other than, hey, let's just go pump and dump this token that really doesn't do anything and that there isn't actually like a company behind. They just have a website and a landing page and they're raising $50 million. Like, it was like, wow, this is an actual business use case that can be applied to all sorts of games. So that's kind of how it's all come together within the last 6 years. But I mean, yeah, so BarPay has been around for 6 years. The Haste Arcade is just over a year old at this point.
Now, with using something like a deviant of Bitcoin, I mean, the transaction fees for Bitcoin, and once we started dealing with crypto, were already pretty high. And the Lightning Network obviously solved a few of those issues. But really, turning to something like Ethereum or a layer two token, such as, I don't know, Solana or Cardano, would make more sense in terms of multiple transactions for lower fees. Have you looked into maybe modeling it on something like that, which now has kind of got a little bit of a proven base in similar microtransactions across various industries?
We have, and the at least for what we need, like Solana doesn't check the boxes, Ethereum doesn't check the boxes, Polkadot doesn't. Like Bitcoin SV is the only blockchain right now that could facilitate our instant leaderboard payouts, which are, you know, pinging the fractions of a cent to people. Now, I wouldn't say that we're married to that blockchain. We like to say we're blockchain agnostic, but at least for today, BSV is the only chain that can facilitate our structure within the arcade. Now, Solana is interesting, and that was one that we were really excited when we first saw them start to kind of take off a little bit last year. But we got in touch with their developers, and we had several like boxes that we need ticked in order to actually use that chain within our arcade. And the two that they couldn't, you know, check for us was, we need a proof of work blockchain, which proof of work, proof of stake, you know, wherever you stand on that debate, so be it. But for us, we're proof of work fans. And then the other one would just be, because we're doing hundreds of outputs per transaction, right now, Solana does not currently have the infrastructure, meaning like a wallet service that can actually facilitate that. They said right now they would max out at about 30 to 40 outputs per transaction. So if the transaction is me putting the quarter in, the outputs are going to be where all these little micro payments are getting dispersed. And so in theory, on BSV, right now our leaderboards top out at 100, but we could expand them to 1,000. We could expand them to 10,000, depending on the gameplay level and how many people are actually playing within the arcade. So BSV, if people know about it, it does have a little bit of a black eye in the crypto community for various reasons that, I mean, we either can or we don't have to get into. But, you know, when you break down the actual tech, it's a layer one solution. It's the cheapest and it has the most transactions per second of any blockchain right now. You can also do tokens and NFTs on it. So it really does just kind of fill all the needs that we have currently.
So I definitely want to get into the NFT thing because I think so many people are still kind of confused on that. But let's back up a little bit. And so if there's somebody that's already lost, which I'm not saying I'm one of those people, but I can I could see some people lost. Can you just like a 30,000 foot level explanation of proof of work versus proof of stake?
Sure. So proof of work, man, and yeah, this it's a little complex, but proof of stake versus proof of work. Proof of work was the original model. I guess that's what Bitcoin BTC was built on. And the notion there is you have all these miners competing to mine a block. So basically from the time a brand new block is, you know, accepted, I guess, by the rest of the mining community, in proof of work, the next block, you're starting it at zero. Like everyone, again, has an equal opportunity to mine that next block. Now, based on how much capital you have, you might be able to afford more mining machines. So you're going to increase your chances of actually solving that block. But literally, like from the brand new block, every single person that is mining has an equal opportunity to at least possibly solve that block. Whereas proof of stake, you have to stake a certain amount of the specific chain's coin or token or whatever to even be considered to mining the next block. And typically what ends up happening is whoever has staked the most, and this is kind of where, like, in my opinion, the rich get richer in the proof of stake version, whoever has the most has a greater probability of being the miner that is selected to solve the next block. So it's not like you're all competing at the same time. It's that in proof of stake, there is one miner that is selected. They get to solve the block, and then the other miners check and make sure that they solved it correctly and that they actually verified the transactions correctly. And if they make a mistake, then they lose some of the coins that they had staked. That's like the penalty if some of the transactions are illegitimate or they end up, you know, accepting a fraudulent transaction. So in my opinion, I feel like proof of work is a little bit more democratic and proof of stake is a little bit more the people that are already in power are going to continue to expand and grow their power over, you know, the person who can only afford, you know, maybe I'm only staking a tiny amount compared to some of these other larger mining operations. So
no, it makes total sense. And kind of where I wanted to go with that was exactly what you said, right? So the proof of stake, if you own a lot of it, you have that better chance of going ahead and being selected to mine the next block. But proof of work, kind of capitalism has already won out again, kind of like you alluded to, that if you can buy more mining and what is it, hash power, if you can buy more hash power, you have a better chance of winning that block. And I know winning isn't the right word, but you get the gist here, right? So is there really any way to have the average Joe be able to compete in that kind of world on a true level playing field?
In my opinion, not necessarily, unless they're buying into a larger mining pool. But I think that also gets into the notion of decentralized and what I believe is kind of a common misconception about what decentralized actually means. So you have certain parties that think decentralized means everyone should be mining and everyone should be a node. So like we should all be running our small operations. And that's how you keep the network decentralized. I think that's a mistake. I don't think that's actually what Satoshi meant. What I think decentralized actually means is that the protocol is locked. The blockchain's protocol cannot be changed, cannot be tinkered with. And when you have that, now you have no developers that can actually say, oh, we're going to implement this or we're going to implement that. That to me is a decentralized blockchain. When there's no people who are actually making decisions and the protocol is set in stone, now I think you have something that is truly decentralized. So that's what I guess to get back to the original point, I don't think you need the small people mining. I think you're going to have major operations the same way that we have, you know, Amazon Web Services. They run, you know, the majority of all the servers in the world. You're going to have major mining operations, people, companies that are spending billions of dollars to build these server farms. But you're not going to have to worry about the decentralization because that should be in the protocol, not necessarily in who's doing the mining, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Now, have you given any thought to maybe creating your own token? I know a lot of businesses have started doing that, again, using the layer two model, mainly on Ethereum. But do you see any advantages in maybe having an identity with that token to BarPay and Haystarkade? I'm not sure of the costs and kind of setting up a token, but I just think it does kind of add a little bit to some type of identity. I mean, it's just like when you have Roblox, when you buy that, you know, in-game currency, that you can only use it for that, as opposed to having a currency which you can spend on anything whatsoever.
Yeah, I think loyalty tokens, I'm actually surprised they haven't taken off already. And I think one of the reasons for that is probably the cost associated with Ethereum, since that's what most people, you know, go to as the token platform. But we do have a Haste Arcade token. And the way to think about our token is, if you went to a classic arcade and, you know, you played skee ball or whatever, whether you got the high score or not, the machine still spits out tickets after the game that you can then go to the prize board and redeem them for like a PlayStation or, you know, a stupid like fake remote control car or something like that. So we do the same thing. So we have the Haste token.
Win a PlayStation. All we can win is like cuddly toys, which magically self-ignite when they pass fluorescent light in.
Not only that, but what do you mean fake remote control car? I mean, my remote control car I got from there wasn't fake. I mean, it was terrible, right? Yeah. And it broke down like 5 days after I got it, but it was real.
Okay, I guess yeah, fake's not the right term. If you thought about how much you probably spent to earn the tickets to get that remote control car, you probably could have bought 100 of those remote control cars.
9 years.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
It's outrageous. I remember like saving my tickets from this place that I always go to when I was a little kid, and it was like 2 years later, I could finally redeem 100,000 tickets for a comb. I was like so psyched.
Yeah, but it, you know, taking the tickets, and by the way, I've always said like Chuck E. Cheese or places like that teaches kids how to gamble, because I mean it is that same thing, right? But you bring up the token thing. I remember going to arcades and you couldn't use quarters, right? You had to put the $5 bill in and get tokens. Yep. And they could change the amount of tokens that you get for that $5, and the game itself maybe needed 1 token, 2 tokens, 4 tokens per credit. So it was kind of up to the arcade owner what was the initial transaction amount for your real money that you put in, and then for the game, how many tokens did it take to get 1 credit to be able to hit start and play?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I guess when you put it like that, so we have tokens that you earn from your gameplays that you can then redeem for our prize board. Eventually you'll be able to use those tokens also to actually play games. And then we have credits, which are more of what you're alluding to. If you're not a crypto person, you know, if you don't want to download a wallet to begin with because you're a little bit sketched out, you can go to the Haste Arcade and you can play for free, or you can buy Haste credits with, you know, a credit or debit card and use those to play in the games. Now, the credits are going to fluctuate because basically what you're doing is you're buying the underlying crypto that you need to actually play in the games that makes the outputs possible. So I might, you know, spend $5 in credits and come back the next day and it's like, wait, I didn't even play yet, but my credits are only worth $4.80 now. It's like, well, the market went down yesterday. So we do have that notion as well for, you know, the less, I guess, interested in crypto community out there. But the majority of the people, I think they're going to learn more about, you know, the currency that we're using, and they're going to end up acquiring that currency to be able to play in the arcade.
Well, I've got an idea for you. So you've got about 15,000 plus members to the BarPay system, right? And I don't know how many users you've had for Haste Arcade, but how about when they set up their accounts, you actually have this little savings aspect to it, where it maybe saves like the equivalent of like 100 increments, say like 100 Satoshi or whatever, into a little savings account. So it's kind of like a loyalty bonus thing that every time they buy these credits to use in Haste Arcade, that it saves like 0.05% of it into crypto and builds up this little savings account, which they can log into their app and see how their little portfolio is growing.
You're taking our secrets, man. Like, you can't be talking about that. We're not ready to make a release about this yet. But yeah, you're absolutely nailing it. And I think what you'll end up seeing is, you know, it doesn't just have to be Haste or Barpay. Like, any individual business could start offering loyalty tokens that you could do just that, what you're suggesting. And I think once business owners start to understand that concept, like, you're going to see a massive move towards these loyalty tokens. And here's why. We have this friend, Jack Liu, who's kind of a Bitcoin OG. He just has a really interesting way of like putting things in perspective. And he was here a couple of weeks ago and he said to us, you know, do you guys want to make money or do you want to create money? And he's like, and this is why tokens are so important. You can go and try and like build a product that earns you Bitcoin or Ethereum, or you can go and create a token out of thin air that you assign the value to, as long as you're actually doing something, you know, to buy back that token or to basically give that token utility. So when you think about that, it's like, okay, I'm a bar owner and I'm going to mint 100 million of my bar's tokens. And I'm going to give, you know, 10,000 of those tokens away every single day to the people that come into my venue. So on a given day, there's 10,000 tokens that are up for grabs. Based on however much my customers spend, the person that spends the most is going to get, you know, 10% of the tokens. The person that spends the second most is going to get 9%, and on and on and on down. Well, me as the restaurant / bar owner, I minted 100 million. Maybe I keep 10 million of those for myself. And that's just something that you can do if we're talking about I'm creating money at this point. So now all of a sudden I have this token that I'm issuing my customers. So they're earning tokens, you know, for doing something they would have done anyways. But because they can now exchange these tokens, right, on a decentralized exchange, or, you know, if it get really big on Coinbase, something like that. Now all of a sudden the tokens that me as the bar owner that I minted for myself, like, they have value. So I just created money for myself. And I think what will be exciting and where that could kick off is like a new restaurant opens. Okay. I'm one of the first customers that goes there. I eat the cheeseburger and I'm like, wow, this cheeseburger is really freaking good. I'm going to load up on tokens to this bar because I know that 6 months from now, this place is going to be hot. Like, people are going to want the cheeseburger badly. So it's going to incentivize, you know, the loyal customers and the early adopters even more to continue to come back to that business and to earn as many of those tokens up front as possible. And that's basically what we do in the arcade. Like, we have a set amount that we distribute in terms of our loyalty token on a daily basis. And we see people who are playing the games just to mine these tokens because they think, wow, 5 years from now, you know, these tokens are going to be really valuable compared to what I have to spend, you know, right now to get them. So I think, yeah, I think that's going to be something I hope within the next 2 to 5 years, we see kind of this loyalty token thing take over in terms of, you know, major loyalty programs.
Yeah. And that leads perfectly into my question, because I brought up on my phone, I use this 7-Eleven rewards program. I stop at 7-Eleven like 5 days a week. And the
five days a week. It's more like 5 times a day, 5 days.
Well,
a week.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
I'm curious, what are you buying 5 days a week at 7-Eleven? I mean,
soda.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Coke Zero and Monster drinks. Mm. Okay. So they have their own rewards program, right? And the girl behind the counter, she always knows me because of my rewards balance, because I've never spent any of these rewards. That's what I was pulling up. I have 36,000 reward points at 7-Eleven, and I can trade them for, you know, a Slurpee or a Coke or, you know, a piece of pizza or whatever. But I don't know why. I just keep collecting them. What's the difference between something like this, like the 7-Eleven's rewards program, and the tokens with crypto?
So you can only redeem those rewards points for 7-Eleven things. Tokens on a blockchain, you can exchange those for anything. So you don't. So basically, if 7-Eleven had a token as opposed to a loyalty point like what you have, you could take that 7-Eleven token and exchange it for Applebee's tokens or for USDC coin or for, you know, whatever other business out there. Whereas the loyalty points that you're looking at on your phone, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think you could send those 7-Eleven, you know, loyalty points to McDonald's and get a cheeseburger in return. That's the big difference. And that's like the interoperability of the blockchain and being able to exchange these tokens for other real-time goods.
Now, just going back to BarPay a little bit, I really loved, you know, the whole theory of having a QR code on the corner of a table, being able to pull up a menu and order from the app.
I hate the QR menus, though. I know you were one of the early creators, but I hate that because I sit there and I scan that QR code and it takes me forever to find what I want in the menu. I like to be able to hold that piece of paper.
Well, my problem with
that. And you're older than I am. Yeah. Like, I don't know how you like the QR menu.
Oh, better. I just like it. My problem with it, though, is that when I have used it at a number of restaurants, they have changed something on the menu, taken something off the menu, but not updated the website that the QR code links to. And there's been a couple of times I've actually placed orders for things which, oh, that's not available today. How do you solve this issue of perhaps restaurants, bars, not keeping the back end system updated and that reflecting badly on the front end app?
Well, what you're talking about is basically why I'm losing my hair. But yeah, it's not easy. And there's really the best solution would be a direct integration between whatever the QR code company is and that restaurant's point of sale system, so that if they go in there and it's called like 86ing an item, when they run out of something, they're like, hey, 86, you know, the French fries. What we've seen at least is the majority of these venues, the general managers, you know, the people that are actually on the floor, they're not interacting with the BarPay dashboard on a regular basis. It's like BarPay is a secondary concern for them. Their POS, their main, you know, computer terminals are where they're doing the majority of their work. And so if you 86 something on one of those POS terminals, if you can automatically get that updated within the QR code, that's the best way to do it. Now, we do that for some point of sale systems, like the big ones, Micros, Aloha, but there's other ones where we don't. And in those cases, like literally the situation that you described happens. Customers will go in there, they'll order, you know, a Bacardi, and the ticket prints out at the bar and the bartender's like, we don't have Bacardi. Like, what do you want me to do about this order? So then, you know, the manager has to go and issue a refund. They have to explain to the customer, oh, I'm sorry, we're out of this. And the customer's like, well, but it was on the app, blah, blah, blah. And that's when you see, you know, frustrations. So, you know, to answer your question, the integration is, you know, crucial to making that a seamless thing. Or you really have to stay on top of the venue and the staff where it's like, hey, if you guys update your menu, you have to do it in two places. And who really wants to do that? You know what I mean? So that has been one of the biggest challenges that BarPay has faced for 5 or 6 years. It's, you know, how do you make sure that the staff is staying on top of what's available on the BarPay system so that it matches what's actually available on your POS as well? So there isn't a great solution for it right now, unfortunately.
You notice how I managed to cover opportunities and threats with two consecutive questions.
Yes, there. That was very good. Yeah. That was very good. So now I'm going to throw another one at you. I've never been a fan of the QR code. I don't know why. I just think it's lazy for some reason. I don't know why I feel that way, but you know, I've got to open up my camera and then I've got to get that in focus. And is there, you know, some 7th or 8th grader that put a different sticker over there and now I'm going to see, you know, never going to give you up,
but
you
know,
get Rickrolled or something like that. Is there a better way on the horizon than that whole QR code? You know, with all the technology and location services and everything, we got to have a better way, don't you think?
Well, let me just say, number one, I'm like you. I'm not a big app guy. Like, even though there's all this technology companies or whatnot that we started and are running, but I would prefer the physical menu too. In terms of, is there something new on the horizon? Not that we've seen. Maybe you have like NFC stuff, so near field chips, where you can basically like tap your phone on something and it'll like extract information and show on your phone. But that's not that much better of an experience. You still have to unlock the phone. The website still has to load. So for the time being, I mean, at least to my knowledge, I think QR codes are going to be the thing that sticks around for a while. I think back, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, they tried to make QR codes a thing and they didn't really catch on because at the time you still had to download an app to even be able to scan a QR code. Whereas at least nowadays, like most of these phones have the QR reader built into the camera, which obviously reduces you know, the entire frustration of downloading an app. So I would say you're probably going to see more development on making it easier to read QR codes than actually trying to replace them altogether. But I could be way off on that.
Yeah, but could it be something almost like my Apple Pay, wherever, you know, I go to 7-Eleven 5 days a week, right? And I go into 7-Eleven, she shoots my little barcode on the Apple Wallet, and then I click another button right there on my lock screen and everything, and then I can pay. Can we get somewhere like that, like you say, that near field technology or whatever, where you walk in and the phone knows, hey, I'm at Tristan's bar, and like a wallet type deal opens up that you tap on and now you can see everything?
You could do that. And that's more, I think it's called like an iBeacon, where you actually like walk into a venue and it'll know, your phone will somehow know, like, hey, I'm at, you know, I think Starbucks actually uses this already. But the issue with that is the cost for the merchants. It's like, that's pretty, not extremely intense technology, but, you know, at least a couple $1,000 more than likely. And for a bar and restaurant owner, it's like, do I want to install this crazy near field technology, or do I just want to print a menu and worry about the other 100 things I have to do today? So it's, you know, the industry itself is pretty old school, and I've seen them be fairly hesitant to new technology. So especially if there's a big cost associated, I don't think that's coming anytime soon from a customer's perspective.
And also you've got the issue of, you know, relying on customers to activate location services to be an always on, and, you know, it's difficult enough to get people to do the most basic thing of turning the sound off on their phone, asking them to go into settings and activate location services for a specific app.
Well, let's also not forget, then you have iOS and you have Android. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating when I'm trying to pay with Apple Pay and like, oh, we don't take Apple Pay, but they have the little logo on there. So they'll take Google Pay, you know, and all of that. So then you have people that are even farther down the spectrum that don't even really know what their operating system is on their phone, and they can't figure out why their phone doesn't work. So we're still probably quite a ways away, just based off of the fact of how we've all grown up with this technology. Some people adopt it, some people don't.
Now, Joe, we actually have a bunch of listeners in India, and some of them probably live in villages where they might have to walk a little bit of a distance for clean water. And so I guarantee you they're listening to the episode thinking, listen to this bunch of bastards talking about touchless payments and the
first world problems.
Yeah, and QR codes for menus. I'm sorry, Joe, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, totally fine. But it's kind of interesting, right? Like Apple Pay, that's not new at this point. That's been around for, what, 5 years maybe? I mean, I guess the iPhone is really only like 13 years old, but you still don't, it's like, I still extremely rarely use Apple Pay. Me and Dan are kind of complete opposites. Like, I'm very, like, less apps, the better. Like, I'd rather be outside than on the computer. Dan's, like, the early adopter who will try any new technology you throw at him. And he's been, like, using Apple Pay since before it even came out. And it's just like, man, I haven't seen nearly as much adoption as I thought we would at this point. Like, the fact that there's still merchants who, they only accept like Google Pay and they don't accept Apple Pay, or they only accept Apple Pay and they don't accept Google Pay. It's like, if we're only there with those technologies that people have heard of, we're still a decent amount away from actually going in and paying with crypto, right? Like, if I'm a merchant and I'm not even doing Apple Pay yet, like, good luck convincing me to accept, you know, crypto number 972 on crypto, you know, Market Watch or whatever. Like, it's just, it seems like we're pretty far from that.
Yeah, but kind of going into your business model, so to speak, the reason I use Apple Pay is because I have an Apple card. And if I use Apple Pay with my Apple card, I get more cash back. And then there's other merchants that I can go to, which, by the way, is why I go to 7-Eleven 5 days a week, because it's an Exxon 7-Eleven. And I get an extra percent on top of that from buying from them if I use Apple Pay with my Apple card. So I've got my rewards and that. That's why I use it.
You get 92 million points. You can get a
Slurpee.
Gallon of gas or something. Yeah.
Well, half gallon now. Yeah. It used to be a gallon.
Yeah. But, I mean, Coinbase, for instance, I mean, they're obviously just an exchange, but they offer a credit card. And you can have a crypto balance in your Coinbase account and you can use that card just like you would a regular Visa or MasterCard, and it is just a tap to use and that pulls out of your cryptocurrency. So wouldn't a model kind of based along that work?
I think it would. I'm still, you know, with like the fees and whatnot associated, I feel like it would be difficult for merchants to really accept that if they're the ones that are having to pay the fees. And then on the other side, like the customers, like if I'm going to use my Coinbase card and go spend my BTC to buy a cup of coffee, paying $6 for my coffee and I'm paying $12 in fees, like just because you can do it, I don't know if it makes sense to do it, I guess is where I think we're at with the mainstream crypto. But that's why, you know, you go back to like Bitcoin SV or a Solana where all of a sudden you can spend $5 and you can pay, you know, a very, very small transaction fee. Now I think you're talking about something with real world utility, but I do think we're a ways away from mainstream people actually being comfortable doing that. I think Solana Pay released recently, and that's like a huge first step, I think, in the direction of actually making that a mainstream thing. But yeah, still, you know, I just, the fees associated with the major cryptos that most people probably have, I just don't think it's something that makes it feasible at this point to go and spend your crypto, even though you can.
Yeah. Well, and even with like the Coinbase card or whatever, there's still a Visa or MasterCard or whatever in the background handling part of that transaction, right? So the merchant, they don't know any different, right? They're just getting a Visa or MasterCard transaction. I think one of the problems that folks have with adopting everything with cryptocurrency is that kind of learning factor and trying to get it easier. Coinbase, I think, has done a pretty good job of making it easier. But I mean, back in the old days, like what you were talking about when you got Bitcoin, right? It's like, here's my wallet. I have to know my wallet address if I'm going to send you money. I've got to know your wallet address. I've got to scan our favorite thing, a QR code for the shortcut, or I can text you this long hexadecimal thing and then send this, and there's going to be a transaction fee. So you want $10. Well, I've got to send $15 through the blockchain. So maybe you get $10. And if I'm trying to do a business transaction, I have to tell that business I sent this amount, but then they don't get the right thing. So people just pull their hair out and say, to hell with this. You know, it's like my dad going to a restaurant. If he can't get a paper menu and has to scan a QR code, even though he has an iPhone, he'll just turn around and walk out. He's like, I'm not going to eat here if I can't have a paper menu. So it with something like, you know, the bar pay or whatever, are we getting more towards that, you know, user friendly, more way of being able to do stuff where people don't have to have all the knowledge about blockchain and Bitcoin and this, that, and the other?
Yes and no. I think what we've talked about with BarPay would be the notion of like using a token to pay for the goods. And that token, I think you would want to be like a stable coin. So imagine like USDC, right? Pegged to the dollar, you're not going to be, you know, affected by price fluctuations. But you do have to have some of the underlying currency to actually send that token, right? So USDC on the Ethereum network, right? If I want to send $10 in USDC, it's going to cost me 19 or 29 bucks in Ethereum fees to send it. Well, I think what you would have and what we're trying to figure out how to do with BarPay is, could we do a stable token on the BSV network? Because the fees are extremely cheap and the transaction speeds are really quick. So what we would want would be, hey, customer, you can come in here, you can purchase, you know, $20 in BSV US dollar tokens, and then that's what you're spending with. So me as a customer, I'm spending $20. I'm getting $20 of this stable token, and then I'm sending that $20 to the merchant. The merchant now is not getting hit with those credit card transaction fees. So they're just taking in $20 of this stable token. Now, if they were to exchange that into cash, they would have to pay fees along the way somewhere there. But I think if you can actually have a stable token that gains global adoption, then it's like, well, why would I ever cash this out? If I can use this at this restaurant, at the next restaurant, at the place across the street, because it's not fluctuating, like why wouldn't all those places want to accept it? It's just a more efficient form of money, which is really what the entire point of Bitcoin, you know, the title of the white paper, peer-to-peer electronic cash, that was the whole point originally. So I think too, what that does, and this kind of gets more into the conspiracy side of things, but it's like, it limits the power in money as well. and it limits what the federal government and the central banks can do. And it in my opinion, virtually eliminates like inflation. And what I mean by that is the government might be the ones creating these stable tokens. They can go and mint a billion or a trillion USDCs, okay? But if they don't have the underlying asset, they can't send them anywhere. They can't move them. So they don't really mean anything unless you can move them. And when you have something like Bitcoin or BSV, where there is only a set amount, you only have that 21 million, if you don't have any of those, you can't create more of those. So you can create as many tokens as you want, but if you don't have the underlying Bitcoin to send those tokens, it doesn't matter how many you print. And that's what I think the inflation thing, or I guess I think that's how it kind of protects against inflation. It's like, hey, the underlying asset is fixed. There is no more creating it. So unless you have it, like, it doesn't matter how many tokens you mint. You have to have this underlying asset.
Yeah. I mean, with Bitcoin, it's proven through its kind of short life cycle to be more of a deflationary aspect, you know, on a roughly every 3 to 4 year cycle, which normally occurs within about 9 months of a halving. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are a lot of coins out there and tokens which aren't built on that same basis. And I think for as many new coins and new tokens have appeared, they've also started disappearing. How do you convince people to buy into something when they already have a limited knowledge up front, but there's also this skepticism of them hearing about all these, you know, fraudulent NFTs and tokens, and you're wanting them to pay money into a token they've probably never heard of and keep that for future use if they don't spend it all on the spot?
I think the answer is utility, like, and utility right now, not future utility, not like, hey, this is what we're going to do, so give us your money now. I think it's like, hey, this is what you can already do with it. And that's what our focus with the arcade has been. It's like, hey, microtransactions are real right now. You can earn from playing right now. You can use our tokens right now. It's not, you know, give us $10 million and then we're going to go build all this stuff that maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. I think that's where people in the mainstream who are skeptical of crypto, and it's like, my friends all the time, it's like, they're like, Joe, I just don't get it. Like, why is it worth this amount? Like, what are people even doing with it? I was like, guys, like, if you're talking about BTC or Ethereum, like, I don't really get it either. Like, I guess I understand you can do tokens and NFTs on Ethereum, but BTC, like, I don't get it. Like, I don't understand why the price is going up. You can't do anything with it. So I think what you'll see is utility in the present is going to, you know, get people over that skepticism. It's like, if I told you I could send you a fraction of a penny, you know, in 6 months versus I just sent you one right now, what's more believable? It's the one that you're actually physically able to see and use in the current moment. So I think that's going to be really the only way that we get past this kind of speculative, you know, pump and dump type environment that we're in right now, which that's, you know, most things start like that. People are going to find quick ways to make money off of new technologies, and kind of like what happened with the dot-com bubble. I think you'll see the same type of deal happen here. But once all the dust settles, you'll see the things that have real utility continue to progress, because they're not based on, you know, they're not dependent on people pumping more money in and speculating on what's going to happen in the future. They're based on, we already have a business model that's working, and we're just going to continue to pursue that.
Perfect segue. Once again, it's like we have all this planned and we seriously don't. But one of the things that we are finding now with crypto is a lot of it, yes, is based off of certain things. There are proof of stake, proof of work, underlying values, things like that. And sure, pump and dumps happen. We all know that. I mean, it happens in the stock market and all that. I mean, look at the GameStop stock, things like that. The one I can't wrap my head around, though, is NFTs, because it's a GIF of a monkey and you say it's worth, you know, all this money. And to me, that's the true like pyramid scheme, pump and dump. Hey, I'm going to make this GIF of a monkey and I'm going to value it at $1. And then you sell it to me for $2 and let's build all this up and then throw it into the metaverse or whatever it is. So I own this animated gift. Just kind of 30,000 foot view again. Prove me wrong, number one, that NFTs aren't just an absolute scam, and exactly why would you want to put any money into one?
I don't know if I'm going to even try to prove you wrong. Like, my personal opinion on what you're describing is that, yeah, that is like a scam. Like, I don't see the value in it personally. Now, that's the beauty of quote unquote art, I guess, is that, you know, some people might value it at like an Ethereum rocket, $1.5 million. Like, if you have that type of money and you want to, you know, flaunt it by buying this JPEG paint made rock, like, so be it, do it. But I think again, like similar to what we were just talking about, the dot-com bubble, I think with NFTs, right now what you're seeing is the very, very first wave of what NFTs could stand for. And digital art is, you know, a very simple thing for people to understand. Here is, you know, the digital proof put on a blockchain. And that's another thing I think people are mistaken. Just because you own the NFT doesn't actually mean that you own the image itself. It means that you own that image on that particular blockchain. So I think what's going to end up happening is, and what I'm excited about is like physical to digital NFTs. So the idea there would be, and this is something that we're toying with, would be how can you take something that you purchase in the real world and all of a sudden, like when you purchase it on the price tag or whatever, there's a QR code, since you love QR codes so much, there's a QR code that you can scan, and basically that's going to send an NFT of that physical item to your wallet. So now let's just say, you know, that little mini Baby Yoda you've got back there. You buy Baby Yoda, you scan that, all of a sudden you've swept, and now you have an NFT of Baby Yoda sitting in your wallet that maybe you can go and use as your character in, you know, a Star Wars game, something like that. That's where I see NFTs going in the future. But you could really apply them to anything. It's really just proof of like ownership of a specific thing in time. It doesn't have to be a piece of artwork. It could be time itself. So for example, and this, I give this example and it loses some people. Other people are just like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. But here's what I would see it. So say you are a house cleaner, you're of a maid service and you have your clients, right? They go and they book a time slot on your calendar in certain time. Well, what you will do in the future is you will mint an NFT for each time slot. So me, for example, I go on your website. I see that from 9 to 10 in the morning, there's an NFT that I can purchase on, you know, for Monday. And so I own that time slot. So if I redeem it, you come to my house and you clean, you know, my house at that time. The next time slot is from 11 to 12. The next one is from 2 to 3, 5 to 6, etc. Well, let's say that I, you know, buy that first NFT, you come, you end up cleaning my house. I'm like, holy shit, this is a really good cleaning service. Like, I'm going to snatch up a bunch more of these NFTs and I'm then going to resell them because I know that other people are going to want this cleaning service once they find out how good it is. Well, you, the maid service, the person who minted these originally, you're going to get a royalty every time the NFT is exchanged after that original sale. So if I buy it originally for $100, you as the minter, you're going to get the $100 up front. But then if someone wants to buy that NFT from me for $150, I'm going to get, you know, a certain amount of that. But you as the original minter are still going to get your royalty of like 10%. So you're going to make $15 more on top of the $100 you already made for that first time slot. So basically, I mean, even like this podcast, for example, you guys could be selling NFTs for guests. So if you want to come on the Thursday at 11 o'clock podcast, you have to go and purchase that NFT. And so I might go and purchase that. You guys are getting the money up front, so you have instant liquidity. And then I might end up selling, you know, that NFT to somebody else that wants to come on this podcast for a higher price. Now, obviously, that might not work with your guys' model because you probably want to know who's coming on the show, you know, before they show up.
But well, I don't know. I guess, depending on the amount of money that they're paying for this, I think we'd have any more. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's just kind of a long way to say, but I guess – in general, I think that what's happening right now with NFTs is kind of, I don't want to say scammy because there are artists who actually put in a lot of time and they do create really cool pieces of digital art. But I think that's just the very, very beginning. You know, you'll start to see NFTs for everything, like the watch you're wearing. You'll go online, you'll buy an NFT of that watch, you'll send that NFT to the actual watchmaker, and that's basically redeeming it. They'll send you the watch. But if you never end up sending it in, the value of that NFT might increase over time. So then you can resell it and that watch is still, you know, waiting for whoever's actually going to redeem the NFT.
Where it makes the most sense to me and where I think the use actually is kind of like your maid service example. But I think about like the old school timeshare, right? Like the three of us, we decide we're going to go buy a house and we're going to divide it into thirds, you know, like a lake house or whatever. And so we all own a third of the NFTs and maybe it's like 10 a piece, but you decide, hey, I've got nine buddies over here that, you know, my third of the time I want to divide up to them and let them kind of have part ownership of the house. Or maybe you come to Tristan and you say, hey, I want out. Will you buy my pieces off of me? Yep. That kind of thing. Or like the title to a car, right?
Yep.
A title to a car could be an NFT and maybe I'm the sole owner and now I sell the car to you and you buy that NFT off of me. And at the same time, I hand you the keys. That to me is where the whole NFT thing makes a lot more sense than a digital picture of a monkey.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think both of you have just kind of suggested the direction NFTs should go, I think, to maybe make use of the technology. But at the moment, I think the only people really making money and are guaranteed to make the money are the marketplaces, which are selling the NFTs, who are taking their percentage sell fee. But, you know, NFTs at the moment, in terms of, as you say, you know, a GIF representation maybe of the Bored Ape series, which was, I think, the first ones to really explode.
Is that why I keep saying monkey?
Yeah.
Because that's the one that...
Yeah, the Bored Ape series of artwork. But, you know, that's only attributed value because if we take, like, the early 2000s where all this kind of, like, new art came out where somebody would shit in a sock and they'd suddenly decide it's worth $16 million, you know... decade or so later, people might have come to their senses and be like, "That's just shit in a sock, mate. It's only worth like about $1."
Yeah, well, but
the same happen to NFTs though? That you buy an NFT for like $2 million, and then somebody decides, "Look, mate, I'm bored of looking at pictures of apes scratching their ass. I'll give you 25 cents for it." How do you then change that value back to something significant?
And to go to my point, it's kind of like we both had Star Wars toys. Mm-hmm. I still have mine. And you say, oh, I have this original Millennium Falcon and it's worth $2,000. Well, it's only worth $2,000 if I can find somebody to give me that $2,000, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So in your exact example, I might say this is worth $2,000, but if I can't find anybody to give me $2,000, it's worth what I can get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree with that 100%.
That's where I see the problem with NFTs coming in, because there's no shortage of NFTs to buy and people are buying them for ridiculous sums. But there was a report out, I think the end of last week, early this week, that the majority of buyers and sellers on NFT marketplaces are within a small group of people. And so, you know, it's like you're buying my NFTs, I'm buying yours, but we're still not paying for them in real money as such on this marketplace. And once we get bored of selling these apes, then what next? We've got to find somebody else because I'm tired of buying them from you. You're tired ducks. Of buying them from me. Yeah, ducks.
Ducks.
The bored ducks.
Yeah.
But what that's coming down to, in my opinion, is the reason I think the NFTs and like these Bored Ape Yacht Clubs and all these super expensive NFTs are really the only thing that we've heard of or seen so far is that if I'm going to go and mint an NFT collection, that costs a lot of money. And like, who can actually afford to do that? Celebrities or people that made a lot of money in Ethereum or Bitcoin in the early days, and now they want to show it off as clout. So you can either go buy a Lamborghini or you can go buy, you know, one of these Bored Ape Yacht NFTs. So like, yeah, I don't mind paying $800 in fees, you know, to make that transaction because I'm buying $1 million piece of art or piece of digital art. But the common everyday person, like, they can't participate in that ecosystem. And that's why I think, you know, people are just like, I don't get it. Like what's the point of all this stuff? And that's where I'm going to go back again to, you know, blockchains at scale and BSV in particular. An NFT does not have to be something that's $1 million. An NFT could be something that is a penny. It could be a t-shirt that I want to put on my character in a video game or a pair of shoes or a pair of socks. Like, it doesn't have to be all this crazy expensive stuff. It could be very, very small valued items, but just within a digital world, like, you need to equip your character with a set of gloves or with a shirt or with shorts. Like, you go to the marketplace and some things are 5 cents, some things are 10 cents, some things are a penny. Those are all NFTs also. It's just, we haven't seen those in the mainstream because the blockchains that are currently the ones that Coinbase is, you know, promoting and the ones that people know about, you can't create NFTs for that small value because the fee to mint them is so high. The only things that are worth creating are things that you can charge tens of thousands of dollars for, which that's why you have a very small market of people who's actually buying and trading these things.
Yeah, it's all fascinating stuff. I mean, we could go on for hours with it, but can you let everybody know the best way to get a hold of you, how to download BarPay, how to download Haste, and reach out to you for more questions or information?
Yeah. BarPay, it's just QR codes. There's no app, so you don't really have to worry about downloading anything. If you go to one of our venues, you'll see like the little cup with the wing on it. That's, you know, there's not really a whole lot of interaction there. Haste, you can go to hastearcade.com or app.hastearcade.com. You can start playing the games there. We're on Twitter, Haste Arcade, Instagram, Haste Arcade, Discord, Haste Arcade. And there's a decent amount of games in the arcade at this point. We've done, I mean, we consider Bitcoin SVs to be Bitcoin. So there have been hundreds of Bitcoins that have been spent, paid out so far in the arcade. And it's all skill-based stuff. So it's not like, you know, you're going in there and gambling. It's just fun little simple games that I think in time we hope, you know, bigger game studios get interested in the leaderboard payout concept we have. But for the time being, these are mostly, you know, just fun online arcade games that if you got a couple minutes to kill, you go play a game, you get on a leaderboard, and then you start getting paid the rest of the day just because people are trying to beat your score. So again, that's just the Haste Arcade. And yeah, that's where I would definitely encourage people to check out.
Very cool. Well, Joe, thanks for spending some time with us. If you're watching this on YouTube, please click the subscribe button. It does help us out. And that will do it for this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd, and we will catch you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, thewolfandtheshepherd.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please leave us a positive review on iTunes when you get a chance. Check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for additional content. Join us next time for another episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd.